Thank you very much, Mr. Gosling, for joining Press TV. As you will speak to us and our viewers, we are still airing images of the missile attacks. I want you to come in right now and give me your reaction, your thoughts, please.
Well, there was actually, I think, a choice that Iran had as to whether to react or not, because there is always a choice, particularly when there's one of these provocations. I think the United States mentality, very much like the British or the Israeli mentality, is that they want always to be taking the initiative in these conflicts. And the initiative sometimes means provoking, doing these provocative acts, like the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Unbelievable to see the White House today even trying to deny that it was an assassination. That was on our main Channel 4 news on ITV here in the UK, all over the country today. American spokesperson saying, you know, it wasn't an assassination. Of course it was. And all of the time that the Americans lie, what they're doing is they're actually alienating many of their own allies, including the British, the Europeans, for example. So one of the tactics that the Iranians could adopt is simply to do very little. And it may be that these attacks on these air bases haven't actually killed US or, you know, European Western troops, that it's been that the attacks have been actually against the infrastructure. Of course, there is an enormous irony in the fact that the attacks on Al-Assad air base have now destroyed the very thing that Donald Trump and the Pentagon was demanding payment from the Iraqis for. So there really is nothing now to pay for. Let's remember the context here. 2003 invasion of Iraq, mainly by the British and by the Americans, was an illegal war. It was an illegal war. And that was proven in the United Nations Security Council. They did not get an extra resolution. The lawyers in London and in Washington gave a false kind of written legal opinion saying the war was legal, but we now know it wasn't legal because it wasn't legal at the United Nations. So what are these US troops even doing there? What are these British troops even doing there? If Donald Trump is a man who likes to stick to the law, as he said, he should, number one, not be there in the first place, but number two, he should honour his election commitment that he made when he was elected president of the US to pull out of these wars. You know, he was even saying, what are we doing there? I think there's many millions of people around the world still wondering what the Americans are doing 6,000 miles away from Washington over there. So I think really the key thing I'd like to hear is any news on casualties at these air bases. But I would also emphasise that there is always the option of not responding to these provocations. And I would always advise that that is seriously considered by anybody who's provoked by the Israelis, the British, the Americans, or whoever. Is sometimes by not responding, you can evoke this reaction. I mean, it's what we call, we have an expression in Britain, it's called letting them stew in their own juice. This is a very old expression in Britain. And what it means is you just leave the person to face the consequences of their own reckless actions without making the response that they're trying to elicit. I mean, you could also say calling America's bluff. It's another way of saying it. But I think that's one of the potential reactions that could take place, particularly if the Iranians are thinking that they want to see what will happen as a consequence in the West of this sort of reckless action. Because quite clearly, the United States has acted totally out of line here, certainly legally out of line, and it hasn't consulted with its main allies at all. So it's likely to cause all sorts of friction and fissures within the Western alliance that they've done something so utterly reckless, another war crime. And certainly you will see, I would imagine, demonstrations, or we've already seen them here in London, on the streets against this sort of thing, but also a sensible reaction within the British military and at the Foreign Office in London saying, well, this is simply a reckless act, and this is not the sort of thing that we can allow one of our allies to get away with. So there will be some very strong words, I'm sure, going from London, or have been over the last few days, to Washington.
Thank you, Tony Gosling. Just hold it there, because we're going to switch over to our correspondent in Washington, D.C., who has joined us via phone to bring us up to date with what is happening in the U.S. Capitol. Colin Campbell, over to you.
Yeah, right now we're just waiting to see what developments there will be coming from the Pentagon, as it seems that the state of revenue is at a new level, and I think Americans are concerned about what the future will be as far as their military is concerned. Biden is transferred over to the other side of the world after an attack, a fatal attack on Soleimani and the others. As the U.S. troops deployed, many wondered whether or not the president said that he did not want to get the U.S. involved in more wars. He's walking back his words that the world is headed into an escalated conflict. And if you look at social media, what people are talking about now, they are wondering.
Okay,
just
I'm going to have to hold you up. I'm sorry, Colin. We're just hearing you intermittently. We're perhaps, you know, trying to dial you once again, see if we have a more stable connection. We're going to get back to you for now. Let's go back to.
Tony, I'm going to have to say goodbye there for a second. Okay.
Analytical view rather than an update until we can get hold of you on a stable connection, like I mentioned. I believe Mr. David Hungerford is also has also joined us within the past couple of minutes, a veteran anti-war activist. And at the same time, I'd like to remind our viewers, this is a live image we're receiving from the southern city of Kerman. That is the coffin containing the body of General Qasem Soleimani, on the hands of the people as it is being escorted to his final resting place. People chanting the slogans of Allahu Akbar, and of course other religious slogans usually given at such times by people. As you can see, people trying to have a share in carrying that coffin, and that is why you see there is a confirmed.
Tony, I'll call you back in a moment, okay? Thank you.
It's basically floating on the hands.
The United States blocked him from doing so. They refused to grant him a visa to go into the UN, and this is a complete violation. Mm-hmm. In fact, I can't think of another time when this may have happened in history. It may have happened, and I just don't know about it. But it's shocking that the United States would not allow someone to speak at the UN, which is what they are legally obligated to let them do. This is the process that the United States wanted when they assisted in the creation of the UN, offered to pay a tremendous amount of money into it, and offered to play host to it. That was part of the conditions. They have to let people come in and talk. There's no other way of putting this together. You can't have a dialogue if you're preventing someone else, has repeatedly gone through all the channels, scaled back the obligations for the JCPOA according to the actual rules and the actual schedule. They have tried to go to the UN to file an official complaint against the United States, completely within line of the guidelines that are handed down by the UN, and the U.S. has sabotaged it every single time. The United States has not played within the rules. They don't even know where the rule book is. They don't even know where they can't even see the rules from where it is that they're acting. And that's very typical of this. Iran has remained within international law, and the U.S. has just completely violated it whenever they felt like it, completely flaunted it, and frankly, that's been typical of them since their nation's founding. And I think that this statement certainly does reflect that. Iran will continue to act as nations and countries and adults are supposed to act in this situation. There are lawful, legitimate processes which they have followed. There are guidelines set down by international regulatory bodies which they have also been complying with, while the United States has completely typified the absolute opposite of that.
Thank you, Jason. Just hold the line for us, please. And let me bring in Mr. Tony Gosling. He is an investigative journalist who joins us back from the city of Bristol. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. I'd like to ask you the same question. Tony, if you don't mind, Iran's foreign minister Zarif saying that Iran concluded proportionate measures in self-defense under UN Charter. Right now that I speak to you, I think this is the most important thing that that needs to be discussed.
Well, I don't know, you know, if you've been receiving this too, but I noticed Ali Arouzi, who's the US network NBC's Tehran station chief, bureau chief. Well, it's actually station chief, isn't it, if it's the CIA. But actually, this is a journalistic organisation. Actually, they have quite close links to these intelligence services, obviously. But this is the bureau chief, not the station chief, Ali Arouzi of NBC in Tehran. He's been reporting, and it's unconfirmed so far, that there is a third wave is threatened of attacks. But that's only if the US responds with more attacks to the initial attacks on the air bases. So the Iranians, it seems, if this is to be believed, are drawing a line under their response to the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. But they are saying that if the US wants to take it further, according to Ali Arouzi, remember this is just the one source, but it's a very good source, that there would be a third wave of attacks against Haifa in Israel and against Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. So, if the US was to get a very heavy-handed and to respond to this with more attacks on Iraqi or Syrian or Iranian soil on the Iranians, then there would be another response. And it's very sensible, I think, for Tehran to lay this out very clearly if this is indeed the case. So that's the breaking news that I've seen around the world. But I think we need to look at some of the, maybe to interpret some of the other little news stories that have been creeping out over the last few days, particularly this letter about the troop withdrawal. It's very curious, and I think if you look at it very carefully, you can see there's a lot of messages in that story that aren't really being communicated to the world at large. The idea that a letter would be sent saying the troops will be withdrawn by mistake, well, this tells me that there is disarray within the higher echelons of the US military. You can understand, of course, that the middle-ranking officers, people in charge of soldiers, individuals who maybe know those people very well, they know their families, they would think, well, this attack on Soleimani is such a reckless act that we believe the best thing to do is to get those young men out of harm's way and get them back to the United States as soon as possible. And then I would imagine what happened is the opposite message would have come down from the very top of the military saying, no, you've got to stay there. And this, I think, is quite illuminating, this mistake of message, which is obviously was an official message, but then it was basically withdrawn. It shows you that there is an attempt at the very top to control the armed forces in a way which the armed forces themselves are not happy with. So this shows discontent, I think, within the sensible, shall we say, side of the US military, saying that these sorts of reckless acts are putting us, our officers and our men, all in harm's way unnecessarily. And that's the sort of provocation which we've seen. The other thing, of course, is the Saudi peace deal. I mean, this is evidence which has come from the Iraqi prime minister, saying that Soleimani was involved in trying to broker a peace deal with the Saudis. Actually, no, he wasn't involved in trying to murder Americans, as the US has said, and that is just simply a lie. Because, of course, they like to try and say that what they're doing is legal. And under international law, the America itself has to be under threat in order to make an attack like this. It's very dubious as to whether an attack could take place in another country. The actual way that the international law is framed is all to do with an attack in the United States against the United States by Iran. Not an attack 6,000 miles away from Washington, where the United States troops are illegally stationed. So that's what international law is saying. But of course, they're trying to twist that effectively in order to get a spin on it. And this is, I'm afraid, all we're getting from from Washington is spin and more spin and more spin. I noticed as well that Donald Trump had to cancel his press conference this evening in the US. Because he was going to give a press conference talking about the US response. So, you know, I think there's, with a little bit of educated guesswork and looking at specific sources, there's actually a lot more to this whole exchange. And let's just hope that that exchange ends right now, because it's quite clear that the Iranians will respond, if this is to be believed, Ali Arouzi's tweet from NBC in Tehran, that there would be a very strong response from Iran if the Americans decided that they wanted to hit back. And I think one of the key factors here will be looking at potential casualties at these air bases.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, of course, you know, because there's no word on that yet, but perhaps, you know, in the next few hours or so, you know, it'll be known as well, so we can discuss that too. But I'm just going to go back to Jason in Niagara Falls to ask him this question. Jason, just a few days ago, after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, of course, a lot of reactions came in. Mr. Zarif, as you mentioned, was barred from, actually was not given the visa. I don't know what that actually means or how it's going to play out, or if the UN is going to take any stance. Don't you wonder that the UN has actually not taken a stance so far? I mean, I was just about to ask you a different question, but just came up that why is it that the UN hasn't taken a stance on not giving him the visa?
That the UN has not taken a stance. The United States has very clearly flaunted the rules of international diplomacy. We see America's calling for a de-escalation of the situation. Before all of this happened, they were still calling for de-escalation, and then they prevented him from entering into the country. Now, I believe that the United Nations is obligated to say something in this situation. The United States has clearly infringed on the process that has been set down by the United Nations, and their silence is almost deafening on this case. They should be saying something. It could be any number of things at this time. We don't really know, because like I said, there's no one saying anything. I'm tempted to suspect that maybe the UN is going along with this. Maybe there's some kind of backdoor deals going on. I mean, for the longest time, the U.S. has flaunted the laws for basically everything, and there have been no consequences for their actions whatsoever. And this is something that's very much within the jurisdiction of the UN to deal with. If there is no dialogue, if there is no meetings, then what's the point of the UN? That was the whole reason why the organization was founded to begin with, to try to mediate the differences between countries so that they didn't end up in war-like situations. So any deliberate hindrance of that goes directly against the reason for the creation of the institution itself. And the fact that they would have nothing to say to the United States for having openly violated that is very telling. And maybe they're behind the scenes, they're thinking about what it is that they're going to do about this. I mean, we don't know, because there are no statements. But we do know this, that the UN should be saying something. They should be stepping forward and denouncing the United States for taking this kind of action. It is not right to simply prevent the organization from being able to function, and that's really very telling in this situation. And frankly, it really does baffle me.
The situation that's still unfolding, the Pentagon or the White House have not either of them come along with statements, or as we expected in the past few hours, President Trump himself giving a statement. Perhaps they're waiting for daylight in that part of the world to assess the what's left of the Al-Assad airbase to perhaps later give some statement as to what kind of damage has been inflicted. But that is too early. We were waiting for the Americans to give their own statement regarding this. We're still waiting for that. On that note of not giving Mr. Zarif the visa to attend the UN meeting, I'd like to ask the same question from Tony. Tony, how do you comment on America's... after all, they don't own the UN, but it seems to me more and more that, you know, when you don't basically give the U.S. visa to a top diplomat of a country to be at the UN session in order, as Jason just mentioned, to have the dialogue, a civilized manner of giving and receiving messages face-to-face, and if you're not basically as a world body, perhaps the most important world body, you don't say anything or react to the U.S. not giving the visa, in what kind of a situation do you think we're facing?
Well, look, I mean, quite obviously, it's not appropriate anymore to have the United Nations headquartered in New York. It's not the place for it. And actually, why doesn't the UN Security Council simply convene in Geneva instead? They've got big premises there. They can convene there instead. Look, let's be fair about the United Nations. It's always been quite a flawed institution. What you've got there is the Security Council and the General Assembly. General Assembly doesn't really have jurisdiction over the Security Council. So what you've got effectively is the military superpowers and NATO are sitting there with the Chinese, obviously, as well, are sitting there making most of the important decisions. And they all, the major superpowers, have the veto. I think in a way the UN is topsy-turvy. What we'd like to see, I think, around the world is some sort of situation where the General Assembly can make binding decisions over the Security Council. All the time you've got the military powers at a higher hierarchy than the ordinary countries from all around the world and the democratic forces from around the world, although obviously some of them are not that very democratic. That is a flawed system, and of course we've seen over the years many conflicts around the world. Particularly the ongoing conflict in Israel and Palestine for decades. In fact, really since the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, officially, ever since then there's been situations that the UN has just failed to resolve. But look, there are other ways to communicate. Come on. I mean, you know, if Zarif can't go there, I'm not excusing the Americans at all. But, well, maybe he could be projected a giant version of him up on a screen live from somewhere, Canada, if the Canadians will let him in, by camera, you know, remotely. So there are other ways to communicate. But this is a clear message to the world that the United States in New York is not a appropriate place to have the United Nations if they're using these childish tactics in order to try and stop proper debate and discussion at the UN. It's clearly a sign to the whole world that the UN, the US is an irresponsible place to have them, and it's going to have to move from New York back to Switzerland, somewhere like that. But look, the US troops in Iraq and the British troops and any other foreign troops in there are, of course, in an extremely vulnerable situation, and they have actually been, really, ever since 2003 and the illegal invasion of Iraq. Those troops and the people there are the ones that would suffer if there are attacks on those bases, and we all knew that. In fact, there was talk here in the UK, what are the British troops actually doing there? They're not training Iraqis anymore. There's only a few score of them, so why not just bring them home right now and make sure that they're safe? Very good idea, but it seems that didn't actually happen as quickly as it should have done. The fact of the matter is, anybody with a memory will know that back in 1983 in Beirut, there was a massive two car bombs attacking a gigantic US and French base in Beirut, where 241, within a few minutes, Marines were killed. And the US Marines, and there were some French as well. So what this led to was the pretty much instant pullout from Beirut of the US Army, the Marines. So this is the sort of thing that if those that were now in the Middle East thought about, hard and fast, that they would know that this is the sort of thing that can happen. When you've got troops 6,000 miles away from Washington, that this is the sort of thing that can happen. Of course, if you go back through history, you'll see that many, many times through history, whether it's Adolf Hitler or Napoleon, trying to fight a battle a long, long way from home with long supply lines, fragile supply lines, and also in a part of the world where people don't speak your language, that you have no real interest other than material resources that you're trying to grab. Napoleon tried to invade Russia, and Adolf Hitler tried to invade the Soviet Union. Neither of them succeeded because it was much too far away from home. And I think the Americans need to just read up on their history a little bit to see the usual and the natural and the normal consequence of trying to fight a battle so, so far away from home. And obviously there are a lot of people in the US military right now who don't want to literally face up to those sorts of facts to do with this. And you know, the other thing is that this is not this conflict that's going on right now in the Middle East, which really started with the 2003 invasion. But there was actually, of course, a precursor in 1990-91, which was the first Gulf War, where everyone was incredibly surprised to see the US suddenly turn up with the Brits in the Middle East to invade or to retake, apparently, Kuwait, to invade Iraq. These conflicts have a precedent in history. It's many hundreds of years ago, but it is very much like the projection of power into the Middle East and into the Holy Land that took place during the medieval Crusades. It's almost as if now there's the same kind of mentality, because anyone that looks at those Crusades will know, again, a complete failure. It's almost as if the same kind of mentality is still desperately trying to control the Middle East, the Holy Land, particularly Jerusalem, and that the Israeli state and the formation of it in the 1940s is almost a kind of fortress, rather like the Crusades. And of course, the same thing will happen this time, is that the whole projection of power into the Middle East, the attempt to take the oil, is two main reasons. The attempt to take the oil of the Middle East so that that can be used to run factories, to run the war machine, and even to fight a world war. That oil is incredibly valuable as that sort of resource. But even in some ways more important is the attempt to control the monotheistic religions, the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims. This is another massive part, I think, of the plan, with these various kind of fake versions of these faiths. You know, the Zionists pretending to be Jews, twisting the peaceful ideas. The same, of course, with the Wahhabists in the Islamic religions. So I think it's a two-pronged approach, and that's one of the reasons why this is going to fail, because previous attempts to do all such things, it's just really a question of how much we can alleviate the problems and the killing and the death in the meantime. And hopefully the US will take this as a very strong signal and get out, and the British will too.
Sure. I really appreciate the time you gave us today, Tony Gosling, investigative journalist out of Bristol. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
U.S. Democratic presidential...
Thank you, Tony.
Okay.
I'd like to appreciate your time as well, sir. Michael Spreeman, former U.S. diplomat via Skype out of Washington, D.C. Thanks for your time. Of course, the images that you see on your screens have been what some of the world media have been showing since the early hours of this morning of the Iranian missiles on their way to attacking the Al-Assad base that is in northern Iraq in Erbil, as well as so much as we're hearing another base which used to station American forces. Of course, Al-Assad base has seen the presence of the U.S. troops since the end of 2014, I might say. And, of course, during the past couple of days, with the rise of the tensions between the two countries of the U.S. and the Islamic Republic of Iran due to the assassination of one of Iran's top generals, General Qasem Soleimani. Of course, the situation is far from normal within U.S. bases. A lot of the troops in Iraq have either been taken to other places in the region or are already on their way to do so, something that you wouldn't expect just a few days ago. After the Iraqi parliament, of course, joined the popular calls for the removal of any foreign troops on their soil, mainly the U.S. forces, since they have the biggest bases in their country. And everything is going hand in hand for the U.S. forces basically to leave Iraq completely. Whether they're going to be stationed elsewhere in the region or where exactly, these are details that are still coming in. But as far as Iraq is concerned, it is far from safe for any U.S. forces, any allied forces, I might say, after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani just a few days ago, as I mentioned. Of course, breaking news on your screens keeps telling you of how the developments are unfolding. This one from Pentagon, who says they are working on initial battle damage assessment of Iran's attack on its Iraq bases. I'm being told that Press TV independently cannot verify the validity as well as the true or how it has been obtained. You know, we cannot independently verify it, but you know, since this has been something that we've been getting within the past couple of hours, we thought maybe we share them with you. Of course, we were waiting for official images, if they have been filmed, you know, to come in so that we can tell you for sure that these are the attacks or have been filmed of the missile attacks. But for now, this is all we have. And then just keep watching Press TV. As soon as we have images that we can verify, we're going to put them on air for you. But for now, this is all we have got. Anyway, like I was saying, Pentagon says they are working on initial battle damage assessment. As you can say, this is early hours in the morning in Iraq, and you know, it's just been a few hours after the attack. And we're in a situation where we're waiting for President Donald Trump to come on and speak about it in a press conference. This is all the information we have at the moment. Again, from the information that I have personally been able to obtain from within social media, it has been said, and I'm quoting this, like I said, from other, you know, numerous sources that have said that the Al-Asad airbase is now basically destroyed completely after a barrage of rocket fires or missile fires from Iran, along with another military base. Of course, Assad airbase in Iraq is an airbase. It has an airstrip of about 4,000 meters at an elevation of something between 150 to 180 meters above sea level. Quite an important base, I might add. You know, we've been hearing that the U.S. had spent considerably in order to bring the base up to date, you know, installing different kinds of installations. A great amount of money so far, as I have been hearing, has been spent on that. So at least in terms of damage that has been inflicted on the base itself, you can say that it is in hundreds of millions of dollars. As you can tell, you know, how much money is needed to basically equip places like Al-Asad with the most up-to-date military machines or military or basically surveillance things. Tony Gosling is joining us. He's an investigative journalist out of Bristol via Skype.